On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Equifax meets justice. Kind of. Everyone is suing the FCC. Cryptocurrency is getting a power outage, and we're running VMware on AWS. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 282, recorded March 16, 2018, VMware on AWS. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by the Kubernetes Engine on Google Cloud Platform. Learn more at g.co/getgke today. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I can't guide you by myself. It's an awfully big enterprise world, and I need some enterprise experts, starting with my good friend, Mr. Brian Chi. He's the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Chibert, how is the geek in paradise?
It's rainy in Hawaii, but, you know, we were actually talking to some engineers recently about putting in a giant PV farm to help offset the carbon footprint of the University of Hawaii. It is a spectacular project, and I'm hoping to be able to go and show pictures one of these fine days.
Wait a minute. The last PV project you were involved with was putting buoys out in the bay. Didn't people just start stealing the PV cells?
Well, that was actually the tsunami buoys, and that was way the heck out in the ocean. And for some reason or another, fishermen decided that they wanted the PV more than they wanted tsunami warning. So that got changed to batteries only to solve that problem.
Yes, and I understand that the new PV farm, they're actually electrifying the cells, so if you touch them, you get shocked, right? That's how that works? Okay. Someone who is not electrifying household items is Mr. Lou Maresca. He is, I don't even know what we're going to call him. We always change his title. I'm going to call him the Super Kamehameha Bigwig at Microsoft. Lou, how are you today?
Fantastic. It's actually beautiful here, and I wish it wasn't because I got my massive Lego Millennium Falcon that I wanted to work on this weekend. So hopefully it maybe rains a little bit.
Wait, how many pieces is the massive Lego Millennium?
I think it's like 7,500 or something ridiculous, but I'm looking forward to the time spent.
That's actually more than the Death Star that they put out a while back.
I know. It's massive. It's bigger than my table, so we'll see how that goes.
Well, folks, that should just confirm that, yes, indeed, we are geeks. Oh, and by the way, we know you're geeks, too, so we've got a special treat for you later in the show. We're going to be bringing in an expert from VMware to answer a question that a lot of you have had, and that is, can I run VMware on AWS? Stay tabbed. But first, we must start the show, as we always do, by jumping into the blips. And it starts with, maybe, finally, a little Equifax justice. Now, remember that month last year when we couldn't go a week without yet another head-shaking Equifax bad news bomb? And then all the following months when it increasingly looked like Equifax was not only not going to be punished, but that their profit had actually increased because of their IT incompetence. Well, finally, a glimmer of hope for those who want to see the C-suite held accountable for their inactions or actions. On Wednesday, the SEC and U.S. Department of Justice announced criminal charges against former Equifax Chief Information Officer Yun Ying, who allegedly sold almost $1 million worth of Equifax stock before the breach was made public, netting him about $480,000. Ying, who resigned in October after the company's internal investigation concluded that he had most likely violated their insider trading policy, was a rising star at Equifax, one who had been offered the global CIO position on September 15th, even after the botched breach recovery. In their filing, the SEC and DOJ detail the case against Ying. On August 25th, he was asked to handle breach remediation for something with the codename of Project Sparta. After hours of meetings and conference calls, Ying started to think that the project was a real breach and that it was Equifax itself that was the focus of the exercise. 2 weeks before the public announcement of the breach, he texted a colleague about his suspicions. 3 days later, his browsing history shows that he had researched the effect of Experian's breach on that company's stock price. That night, he exercised all of his auctions, buying $500,000 of stock, which he sold for $1 million. Of course, while it's nice that some justice will be served, this announcement brings up so many other questions. Namely, why did it take 5 months to charge Ying after the internal investigation found enough evidence to terminate his position? Why haven't any named executive officers been charged when at least three of them sold a total of $1.8 million of stock in the days after the breach, but before the announcement? And why hasn't there been any punishment of the company itself? But still, justice. A little. Right?
So you have your favorite text editor. I have my favorite text editor from VS Code, Sublime, Emacs, Notepad++. But what makes these editors so unique? Well, the simplicity of them, of course, and also the plugins. Syntax highlighting, autocomplete, IntelliSense, formatting, linters, and tons more. What if I told you that your text editor's plugins are poking gaping holes in the security of your machine? Let me guess, you're going to go stop what you're doing right now and you're going to head over to your favorite text editor and you're going to shut down all the programs and plugins, right? Well, you probably want to. A fellow researcher at SafeBreach, Dor Azori, did an analysis of a bunch of popular text editors for Unix, Linux, like Sublime, Vim, Emacs, get it, and Pico Nano. What did he find? Well, he found that except for Pico Nano, all of them are vulnerable to a critical privilege escalation flaw that could be exploited by attackers to run malicious code on the victim's machine. Surprised? Well, when it really created a gaping hole in it, the editor root-owned files, and they opened the editor with elevated privileges using sudo in order to use and access special files. Where does the issue lie? Well, the issue resides in the way the text editors load the plugins. According to the researchers, their inadequate separation of regular and elevated modes when loading plugins for these editors caused the issue. What can you do to protect yourself? Well, you could sure avoid loading third-party plugins and also making sure that they don't run in elevated mode. Also, deny write permissions for non-elevated users. That's it. Follow those rules and you should be safer than before. Who knew that our favorite editors could be out to get us?
It's time to pile on the FCC. Okay, so far, 12 folks have filed and subsequently been combined into a single case. Mozilla, Vimeo, Public Knowledge, Open Technology Institute, New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, along with the Democratic Attorney Generals from 21 other states and District of Columbia, National Hispanic Media Coalition, Benton Foundation, Free Press, Coalition for Internet Openness, representing tech companies, Automatic, Foursquare Labs, Etsy, Expa, Kickstarter, and Shutterstock. Etsy is filing also by itself, the California Public Utilities Commission, and the County of Santa Clara, California. The lawsuits are all filed in either the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit and the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. As is standard, there was a multi-circuit lottery to determine the venue, and the Ninth Circuit Court based in San Francisco was randomly selected to hear the case. I wonder why Hawaii isn't specifically listed. I suppose they're probably part of the combination. But I sure would like to wish these folks luck because I like it.
Now, for a few months now, we've been ringing the warning bells about the explosion of commercial cryptocurrency mining and the effect on the power grid. Well, with the price of Bitcoin and Ethereum driving ever more people to try to cash in on the crypto wave, large crypto operations have been looking for small cities with access to abundant, inexpensive electricity. The inherently inefficient nature of cryptocurrency mining meant that we were getting to the point that these operations had the ability to push municipal power grids past their limits. Well, one municipality is pushing back. The city of Plattsburgh, New York, has enacted an 18-month moratorium on new commercial cryptocurrency operations in order to determine what can be done to minimize the detrimental effect crypto mining has done on the city's citizens. Specifically, residents of Plattsburgh have seen their electrical bills rise dramatically as cryptocurrency operations moved in. Once comfortably under the allotted power budget, the crypto operations have pushed the city's power usage far past that budget, forcing administrators to purchase power from the open market at higher rates, the cost of which was then distributed to all the citizens of the city. Rates have increased as much as $100 or $200 a month, even if residential usage stayed the same. In fact, just one of the commercial mining operations, CoinMint, used 10% of the city's allocated power budget by itself. Looking at the working of the local law, it's obvious that the city managers consulted actual tech competent advisors. They properly defined cryptocurrency, commercial mining, server farms, and high density load service. Score that as a win for proper tech policy. The law allows the moratorium to be lifted sooner than 18 months, should the city find a solution to the skyrocketing power usage, but we can probably expect these kinds of laws to become more popular as crypto mining pulls ever and ever more power.
So we're all tech enthusiasts here. You probably heard about Mobile World Conference going on over the last month, and numerous news outlets and tech blogs covered that, and they've covered their favorite things and what they thought was cool. Did you get anything out of those reports? Well, I didn't. Well, what I was most interested in is the trends, what companies and manufacturers, visionaries and inventors are sending us a message. Well, let's take a look at the what's actually coming out of this machine learning output that they put on the Mobile Conference announcements. What are the trends? Well, first things is obviously 5G had been in the wind to date, but 5G chips on their way out. Hawaii's announced its first 5G chip and will support the new 3GPP standard for 5G networks, and then it can download data at 2.3 gigabytes per second. With this coming to the reality, consumers might also hold off on their next device purchase until the tech rolls out. Smart glasses, they're back again. The glass holes are in the wind, but Tuz, which is the joint venture between Zeiss and Deutsche Telekom, the parent company of T-Mobile, have a 5G for sports use, a 5G device for sports use for industrial applications and even daily wear. What's next? You guessed it, AI. The world of wireless is betting on emerging technologies like AI to create new products and services. First things first, making networks more efficient. What would be nice is not to drop conference calls during those network congestion times. And of course, next, IoT or Internet of Things. The force is strong with them. Worldwide expenditures on augmented reality, virtual reality is expected to hit $17.8 billion in 2018 and a 95% raise from last year. IoT is the forcing function for digital transformation. Some of the core themes were management, connectivity, and the sensors utilizing computers at the edge of the network to make everything, quote unquote, smart. There's also the plethora of applications that can manage all these sensors, with which are the proliferation in the field, which we can tell from the Mobile World Conference, the future is quite bright for mobile devices, and it's starting to blur the line quite a bit between desktop laptops and might just even become blurrier.
Well, sadly, AMD joins the club with the critical security flaws in its CPUs. It seems that CTS Labs, a security company based in Israel, only gave AMD 24 hours to respond to their report. Some summaries are indicating that the security flaws are in the same class as Spectre, but this time for the Ryzen series of AMD CPUs. What's troubling some analysts is the extremely small window given to AMD to respond to the report before it was made public, which kind of, you know, you got to ask yourself, was this real flaws or stock manipulation? Anyway, CTS Labs hasn't given too many details about how the flaws work. As a precaution so that malicious actors don't start exploiting them before AMD has a chance to fix those flaws. At the same time, the company only gave AMD 24 hours notice before publishing its materials. The security researchers said they don't know if any of the vulnerabilities are already being exploited in the wild, but they are concerned about the Chimera firmware and hardware backdoors found in the AS Media chipsets. They conclude the report saying that the existence of these major flaws in AMD's processors is due to AMD's disregard for fundamental security principles. Keep this in mind. This is not Spectre, not related to Spectre, just like Steve Gibson just said. It's a coincidental timing for the release, which kind of makes you scratch your head about, what's going to happen to their stock, and has someone started shorting AMD? Well, hey, we may need to go back to the Motorola 68000-based systems like I used to use at Xerox.
Now, we're all connected all the time, but might it be healthy to get offline every once in a while? And what might that downtime teach us about the reliability and redundancies of the various networks that have grown up around us? Those are questions that might be answered tomorrow when the island province of Bali will be turning off the internet for 24 hours to mark their annual day of silence. Government authorities have asked telecom operators to shut down the internet, which will certainly be a fascinating experiment in mindfulness, but also, for us network geeks, a masterclass in shutting down layers of networks, then bringing them back up. Here's how they plan on it working. Phone and SMS on mobiles will still work, but no internet connectivity. Wi-Fi will be available at hotels and public safety critical locations like hospitals, airports, and police stations, but Wi-Fi and wide connectivity at private residences will cease to work. The government is depending on each network operator to find the best way to disable internet connectivity while still providing voice and emergency services. Then, each network operator needs to find the best way to bring millions of devices back online with the least amount of disruption. Having recently been disconnected for 30 days myself, I have to say that I could use a little internet silence, but I'm more interested in seeing if they can pull this off without a host of unintended consequences from a province of the world's most connected country. That does it for the blips. Next up, we're going to head to the bites. But first, let's take a moment to thank a sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech. Now, this episode of TWiET is brought to you by the Kubernetes Engine on the Google Cloud platform. Now, when you're building an application, you need it to be fast, secure, and always evolving. With the Kubernetes Engine, developers can easily deploy containerized apps on a fully managed service from Google Cloud platform. Google has been running production workloads in containers for more than 10 years, and they built the best of what they learned into the Kubernetes Engine. The Kubernetes Engine combines automatic scaling, updates and reliability, self-healing infrastructure with open source flexibility, all to cut down your development cycles and move from idea to production quickly and reliably. The Kubernetes Engine handles scheduling deployments for your workloads to maximize resource optimization so that you can do what you do best, focus on your apps. Auto-scaling allows you to handle increased demand of your services and will scale back in the quiet periods to save you money. Now, Google is the only hyperscale cloud provider to offer an SLA for clusters running on Kubernetes. It's also backed by experts on Google's security and reliability engineering team and is both HIPAA and PCI compliant. Now, worried about getting locked in? Don't. Because with the Kubernetes Engine, you're free to take your workloads out and run them anywhere Kubernetes is supported. To learn more about the Kubernetes Engine, go to g.co/getgke today. That's g.co/getgke. One more time, g.co/getgke. And we thank Google and the Kubernetes Engine for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Let's go ahead and move into the bites. And this is actually good news. It's nice every once in a while to have some good news on TWiET. I know we'd have a lot of doom and gloom. We spend far too much talking about breaches and net neutrality, but this time it's actually a good thing. And that is, we might be looking at a completely encrypted web in the very near future. Now, we know that in July of 2017, there was a nonprofit certificate authority, Let's Encrypt, that promised to deliver a product, something, a service that would put secure websites and web applications within the reach of any internet user. This was a wild card certificate, a way for you to enable encrypted communications without you having to go through an expensive CA. Well, it sounds like that's actually going to get live. Today, Let's Encrypt took that promised service and they made it a reality. In addition to a new version of that automated certificate management environment, an interface has been created that allows you to use a variety of client software packages to automate the verification of certificate requests. All of this means that even a non-tech web operator can now encrypt their traffic. Chibert, I'm going to throw this over to you. This is more in your bailiwick. But does this mean that we can finally get rid of HTTP and say everything should be HTTPS?
Shame if you are running HTTP. No, the reality is Let's Encrypt has had single machine certificates for quite a while. Now, there's a caveat here. It's not like the traditional CA authority. You have to be able to run a piece of basically it's Python code, and their system's called ACME. And so it's automated certificate management environment. So it has been available for Apache and Nginx. It's also available for IIS, and I believe it's also available for VMware now. And the idea is they've shortened the lifespan of all the certs. So instead of buying a cert for a year, these are swapped out every 90 days. So the advantage of this is that if there has been a key compromise, it's 90 days. So that's kind of cool. So if you had a misissuance or something like that, it's not the end of the world, at least, you know, until the 90 days go on. And the system will automatically reinstall the new cert, get a new cert and stick it in. So it has to be able to, the platform has to be able to run piece of software. Now, the interesting thing is it'll run even on a Raspberry Pi, which is super cool. But the wild card is big deal. So if you're running a major corporation with, say, a proxy in front of it, you could actually offload the SSL onto the proxy, which is what a lot of people like doing, especially if you're playing the game of the F5 or something like that. You can put the wildcard in front, and that's actually a certificate for your entire domain. So that's a lot less work. Now, this is also a pretty big deal because if you're offloading it, one, that means your systems aren't working as hard doing all the individual SSL decryption. But it also means that your IDS, IPS stuff are looking at it in a trusted area, unencrypted, so they'll be more efficient. So it's pretty big deal, and it couldn't have happened to a nicer industry because, boy, oh, boy, those CAs are really expensive, and they add up really, really fast.
Yeah, that's what I was just thinking of. I mean, this if this actually works even a little bit, like they say it's going to work with the auto-provisioning, doesn't that basically get rid of the CA business?
Yeah. You're considering, you know, if even the second or third tier CAs, I'm still looking at something like, I think it was $700 or $800 a year for a wild card.
Yeah.
$300 for a single is that, wow, that adds up really, really fast. So I, you know, it's not going to get rid of all the CAs. You know, it'll be still nice. I'll still need a CA for appliances that can't run Acme.
Right.
And so forth. But more and more of the IoT devices are going V6 and they're going SSL, or actually in this case, TLS. So having a way of getting your CA, your certificates a lot cheaper, in this case free. I think that's going to be the tipping point. I don't think CAs are going to go away, but I think it's only going to be the big boys left.
Right. Lou, I want to throw this over to you because, of course, there's always going to be backwards compatibility problems. And as Chibert said, there is some gear that we've got running in our colos and our data closets that will not play well with Let's Encrypt. So, of course, we're still going to need a CA for that. But here's the thing. I see this as putting more power into the hands of the IT manager and the CTO/CIO, because now they can essentially tell the CAs, we might need you for one or two things, but all of the things we used to use you for and all those really expensive certificates we used to buy on an annual basis, yeah, we're just going to get that from Let's Encrypt now. I mean, that this should trim down the number of CAs, and it should make the number of CAs that are left far more diligent in actually doing what they're supposed to do.
So I think there's a couple parts there. First part would be, yeah, obviously backwards compatibility is a big thing. There's lots of devices out there. And, you know, using that as a forcing function against the CTOs and CIOs of the world, I don't think that that's going to work to some point, only because we see things like Internet Explorer old versions. We see old versions of Windows in the wild. And those are still not forcing functions to upgrade. Is it as expensive to upgrade for those things? Well, for browsers, it isn't. I mean, I think there's reasons why they don't upgrade compatibility. There's, you know, they put a lot of money into the devices that they have and so on. So it's going to be a slow trickle of upgrade at some point. So I think that's going to go. Another thing is a level of trust. So Brian pointed out that Emily the Strange pointed out that, you know, enterprises might not want Let's Encrypt. And that's because having a CA that you pay for the security is something that enterprises do. Enterprises like to pay for things. They like to pay for the security that they get from a big business that offers such a thing like a certificate, like encryption. And so offering something that free tends to be, well, why is it free? What, you know, is it as secure? Is it this? Is it that? And so there's going to be a little bit of that as well. Even though it's a misnomer, it's going to be out there in the wild. So I think there's going to be quite a bit of delay, even though it's great and I'm going to put it on my site and I'm going to put my devices and my software. It's definitely going to be a delay for enterprise and the corporate world.
Right, yeah. And Emily the Strange in our chat room has said exactly that, which is, look, this is great because choice is good and we like the ability to make things more secure far more easily than before. But as both you and Chibert have said, the big box manufacturers, Cisco and Nokia and Microsoft, they're probably going to want you to stay with a traditional CA. I get that. That totally makes sense. But Chibert, maybe you can expand on this a little bit. The fact that there is now a way to do this automatically for most of your gear that's not in the data center, and that it's easier than creating self-signed certificates and more secure than creating self-signed certificates, means that, again, the CAs that are left will have to actually do what they were paid to do. We've had so many stories over the last couple of years of CAs that were basically just taking the money and not doing any of their due diligence to make sure that the certs were being used properly. This should cut that back, right? Because, I mean, if you're one of these companies that's on the edge, like, oh, I don't know, one that Google itself has penalized because they did such a piss-poor job, you just go out of business.
Yeah. Actually, I'm going to sidestep that question just a tad. So lots and lots of enterprises for their primary websites are probably going to want a traditional CA. But lots and lots of people, you know, there's actually web servers on Cisco routers. And do you really want to pay for a traditional cert on a router, for God's sakes? It's only your internal people are going to be using. The interesting thing is the article that we're scrolling through right now is actually a procedure on how to put Let's Encrypt onto a Cisco router so that you can have a real, honest to God cert. It's Let's Encrypt cert on your Cisco routers. And it's also on the F5 big IPs. So I think we're going to at first see a mix. We're going to be using Let's Encrypt for the sites and devices that we may not traditionally want to pay for a real cert. And the enterprises and large organizations are probably going to want to go and use the traditional. Now, Nick, yeah, sure you can self-sign, but do you really want to go and, you know, that means you have to protect the keys. If you really want to go further and set up a PKI facility within your organization, wow, that's a real pain. Also, it means that you have to go through that painful process. You have to go and bring it up, tell the web browser that you trust it because you're self-signing. Then you have to download the cert and get it into the cache on that particular browser. I've gone through that trying to teach administrators how to do that, and it is god-awful painful, and it creates an amazing, amazing support load. So if I have devices that have internet access so that I can go to a CA, in this case, Let's Encrypt, it just makes a lot of sense to be having a real cert from, in this case, the EFF, Let's Encrypt. And now I can go all SSL, all TLS, all HTTPS on all my devices and close up those holes. It's not a magic bullet, but it goes a long, long way to solving some of these security holes that could potentially, you know, if you have a router, you can make a SPANS port and now all of a sudden you can steal a lot of information. Wouldn't it be great to have less things to worry about? And yes, ZipDog, it's also a huge time saver.
Yeah, yeah. And I think we should make this clear. This is not a forklift upgrade. This is not getting rid of everything. It's just going to make it a lot easier to do a lot of the things that you've been wanting to do, but were held back either because of complexity or cost. We've got Nick in the chat room who asks a very good question, which is, couldn't you just self-sign before? And absolutely, you can still do that. You can still self-sign. But if your equipment supports the ACME protocol, and you can centrally manage all your certs, expire the ones that should no longer be valid, make sure that they're not being misused, that makes a whole lot more sense. And in the long run, that becomes so much easier to manage than trying to do a bunch of self-signed certificates that you use and then try to expire manually. Lou, I'm going to give you the last call on this. Let's Encrypt is just one company that's trying to work on these kinds of solutions. I'm hoping that they see a lot of success with this. I'm hoping that manufacturers actually start including this as a default option on some of their gear. That would be wonderful. I mean, I'd love to see Synology just make this a basic function on their Soho routers. Where do you see this going? I mean, how much critical mass do we need before we can finally say this is table stakes? You must support Let's Encrypt and the ACME protocol if you want to sell any piece of hardware.
I mean, you have to get critical mass in the industry. I think that startups alike, small businesses that are building small appliances, they're all going to start using this because it does, you know, narrow their costs, not only on their operating costs but, and their manufacturing costs, but also when they, you know, customers pay for it, they can reduce the cost there as well because you have a different cert for every device and so on and so forth. I think that By that happening, it'll start to add critical mass to the industry. And then as consumers and businesses alike start to move on to it, it'll force it forward. But not until you have that. I think, you know, more and more websites and more organizations are going to have to start using this. And maybe Let's Encrypt should start, you know, giving that data, those analytics to the wild to show how many people are actually starting to move off of it, onto it, how they're saving costs in their business and how they're using automation. And by showing those examples, again, it'll just be a forcing function for the industry and organizations to move forward. And then you'll get that critical mass, and then it'll force large things like browsers and so on to kind of support it. So I think that's kind of how anything happens in the industry. And that's what will happen with this as well.
It's time for my favorite part of every show. And that's when we bring in an outside expert to drop some knowledge on the Twiat Riot. And it is with great aplomb that I welcome Mr. Ivan Opernchurch. I practice it. I probably messed that up. I'm going to say Opernchurch, and he can correct me. He is the Director of Product Management at VMware. Ivan, thank you very much for joining us on This Week in Enterprise Tech. Did I even get close to the right pronunciation?
Close enough. It's Opernchurch. Opernchurch. Everybody gets it wrong, so I'm used to it, and it was close enough.
Well, fantastic. Well, welcome. Now, you are the Director of Product Marketing at VMware Cloud on AWS. Now, that combination may sound really short, but it's actually super, super important. Your team has been working on making VMware and VMware-enabled applications work on Amazon's web services. Tell me what this process was like. How long did this take?
So we started working with AWS about, at this point, 2.5 years ago. We announced a product 6 months ago at VMworld. So before, between VMworld and the initial time we started working on it, it was about a year and a half worth of development. You know, definitely a large investment on our side, a large investment in engineering on AWS side to bring the service together.
Yeah. Now, everyone here who's listening or watching the show, we know what AWS is. We've actually had them as a sponsor of the network. But let's do a quick beginner's guide to AWS. We know that AWS is Amazon's web services. It's their way of offering dynamically allocated resources to those people who want to run things in the cloud. What operating systems are currently supported by AWS?
So VMware Cloud and AWS, the software stack itself is based on vSphere, and actually it includes VMware NSX and VMware vSAN. But because it's based on vSphere, the operating systems that it supports are the same operating systems that vSphere supports on-premises. So you get all your usual flavors of Windows, Linux, and even Unix.
Right. And can we do thin apps like I can with my SaaS applications?
Yeah, absolutely. There is no restrictions in terms of what type of applications are running on VMware Client AWS. This is a infrastructure as a service, so you can deploy applications that serve up 10 clients, applications that have mobile clients. Even recently, we announced a desktop as a service in a preview mode, so you can actually run desktop-based applications from within VMware Client AWS.
Right. I was just at Enterprise Connect 2018 in Orlando, Florida, where we've got a lot of UCaaS vendors offering their wares. And one of the big trends is companies who say, we're doing security first now. We're not doing security as an add-on. It's not something that we hand the product to a team and then they figure out how to secure it. They actually start with security and then they build the service on top of that. So I'd have the same concerns about running anything on AWS. What kind of security can I build into a service that I run on Amazon's cloud?
Absolutely. So we take security very seriously as any of the other vendors in public cloud would. Now, in terms of VMware Client AWS, let me kind of break it up into a couple of different areas. Security is also a very large topic. So a couple things there. So VMware Client AWS, the environment itself, when it comes to privacy, confidentiality, and so forth, we have a number of built-in features, whether that's things like NSX and firewall that comes in that our customers can take advantage of. But also because it's a vSphere-based environment, customers can bring in their own favorite security tools and security products. So be it something like Palo Alto Firewall or Trend Micro Deep Security, all those products, all those third-party products that are typically running and helping with security are supported on VMware Client AWS. So that's on that kind of confidentiality, privacy detection, and authorization level. When it comes to user authentication, we have a built-in restricted privilege model. So there's certain things within the infrastructure that we do not give the administrators, the users of the environment access to. Those are managed by the VMware. And what this ensures is that VMware takes care of all the infrastructure security, and the users, the application developers, or the infrastructure teams that are interacting with the service then only worry about running the applications and security applications. So that's within the service. Now, for developers that want to run applications in the VMware Cloud AWS environment and want to take advantages of the AWS services that our environment is sitting next to, there's also a number of different security options that they have. So in terms of authorization and authentication, we rely on the AWS Identity and Access Management. This allows customers to create users and groups that give them access to specific AWS services. Now, in terms of securing the confidentiality and privacy of communication with these services, customers can take advantages of a lot of the VPC features that are available, whether it's firewalls, whether that's using TLS to encrypt communication with the AWS service to workloads that are running in VMware Cloud AWS. So that's kind of the second area. The third area, we are very big. Our offering is, we consider offering as a hybrid cloud, where we allow our customers to connect their VMware Cloud AWS environment back to what they might be running on premises through a new VMware feature called Hybrid Link Mode. Now, when it comes to the Hybrid Link Mode, the connectivity back on premises is secured through your usual VPN type of mechanisms. Again, customers can use firewalls of their choice. But also, in terms of authentication and authorization, we connect to the user domains that are being used on premises. So customers then essentially are leveraging the authorization, authentication, auditing mechanisms that they have for their on-premises vSphere deployment.
Right. What about like MFA? MFA has got to be built in, right?
So that is one feature that we currently don't have available, but it is very much on our roadmap.
Okay, good. All right. So that's security. Now let's talk about visibility, because this is the other thing that way back when, before people realized that it was fine to move things into cloud services, they were concerned that they wouldn't be able to get the same sort of metrics that they could with on-premise equipment. What kind of visibility do I have into the services that will be running in VMware on AWS?
So again, the environment itself is very much, it's an infrastructure as a service. It's based on vSphere. And whatever tools customers are accustomed to using on-premises for, their visibility and monitoring needs, those are available. So these include tools from VMware, whether it's things like Wavefront or, our log intelligence tool, or whether it's other third-party applications customers typically use for visibility monitoring purposes.
Okay. Now let's actually jump into it, because we're here to talk about VMware on AWS. We've been sort of teasing what are some of the foundational features. But if I was the IT manager at a 10,000-seat enterprise, this is our theoretical 10,000-seat enterprise, and I am now looking at taking my applications that I'm running on my VMware cluster that's currently located in my colo and moving things into AWS, what kind of challenges am I going to run into? What do I need to know ahead of time? What are those things that I can do to make that transition easier?
So this is normally when we talk to customers and they're thinking about going to a public cloud, essentially moving from on-premises into different public cloud offerings that are out there, typically they run into features where the environment is not the same or is inconsistent with what they get in public cloud. This is one of the key value propositions that we have for VMware Cloud AWS. The infrastructure that we're running on and the way you operate that infrastructure is identical to what you would do on premises.
Nice.
So, for example, if you want to move workloads, it's as simple as using vMotion, a very popular and well-known VMware feature. So you can live migrate running applications from your on-premises into VMware Cloud and AWS without having to do anything. I mean, assuming that you have your network configured, you have your direct connect set up and so forth. But once you set that basic network connectivity, rest of it is just point and click, and applications are moving. So you can use vMotion to move a single application. You can use our service we call Hybrid Cloud Extension that allows you to move tens, hundreds, even thousands of applications at the same time. In fact, I had a customer a couple of weeks ago that they started their migration on Friday afternoon, and they thought it was going to take a long time. But Monday morning, they moved 150 of their workloads, their VMs into the service. And you know, I got an email in the morning saying that is acceleration, that is fast.
So if I've already virtualized my application, it just goes right over. I shouldn't notice. Wow.
As long as it's running out of vSphere, as long as it's a vSphere-based workload, point and click and it goes in there.
How does this work with VMware's existing suite of cloud management software? Because you've got some wonderful tools that allow me to shift workloads dynamically. Does the AWS cluster just look like another cluster, or do I need to use a specific piece of software to do that?
It looks like just a VMware software. In fact, through the hybrid link mode feature that I mentioned initially, customers that are using our vCenter management tool basically can connect the VMware Cloud AWS environment, the management of that environment, with what they're running on premises, and they get a single pane of glass in the same exact way they've been accustomed to seeing it on premises. With you know, not now that includes VMware Cloud AWS, and so the same way they were operating in it, same way they were managing it is the way they do it in VMware Cloud AWS.
Who is the ideal customer for this? Who's going to come to you and say, "I've got VMware running on my colo. Maybe I've got VMware running in a separate cloud operation, but now I want to move over to AWS." Who do you see as the target for this particular feature set? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So in terms of customers that we have on the service, it kind of cuts really widely across the board. So small customer, medium size, large customers across all the verticals. I would kind of put it down to, you know, what is the use case? What is your use case for public cloud? And we see three categories of customers. We have customers that, you know, over the years, made investment in their on-premises infrastructure, whether that's in people, the infrastructure itself, processes, and so forth. And they're looking at public cloud. They don't necessarily want to get out of that infrastructure. They want to continue using it, but they see public cloud as a ideal place for very specific use cases. You know, disaster recovery is one good example of that use case. On-demand capacity, when I have that seasonal workload, whether it's a tax season, shopping season, and so forth, being able to spin up capacity in minutes is very valuable to them. Customers that are looking for additional capacity for a specific project, or something that's longer term, and that's an ideal environment for them. Or customers that have specific type of workloads, for example, for dev and test, they want to move their entire dev and test environment. That is a kind of a good use case there. So that's for customers that made an investment in their infrastructure. Then we also have a category of customers that want to get out of what they have on premises, want to move into public cloud, essentially want to migrate their infrastructure into public cloud. Now these come in a couple different flavors. There's the customers just want to move a single applications, being an Oracle workload or a specific HR app. Customers that want to move part of their infrastructure because they're refreshing it, they need something that's more modern, faster. They move that portion of the infrastructure into VMware Cloud AWS. Or customers that are in colo, as you're mentioning, they want to shut the whole thing down and go public cloud and want someone else to entirely manage it for them. So that's also a good use case for that type of a customer. And then the final category of customers where we see AWS is doing a lot of innovations around the different services that they have, whether it's IoT, Lambda, or the other 90 plus PaaS type of services they have. And as developers are looking at these services and trying to either build new applications or modernize existing applications, they want to take advantage of those services. Now, VMware Cloud AWS sits next to VMware, next to these AWS services, and we have engineered direct connectivity to the AWS services, so it gives you the high performance, low latency that you would expect as if you were running those workloads out of native EC2. And because we're so close to the services, another set of customers that we get are the ones that want to modernize their applications, build their next generation application using the typical VMware tools they're familiar with, using all the security, the policy, all the processes they build out over the years with VMware, yet being able to take advantage of these new AWS services for their applications.
Ivan, one more question before I bring my co-host back in, because I can see them in my preview monitor and they're kind of chomping at the bit to get into this conversation. And that's a callback to an episode we had 2 weeks ago with Dell. And they were talking about GDRP and what the General Data Protection Regulations that are taking effect over in the EU have on network and network services. Is that something that had to be discussed in your calculus as you were preparing to release this? Because when you're dealing with AWS, of course, you're dealing with services that can be geolocated pretty much anywhere, be accessed from pretty much anywhere. Does that change how you structure your product release?
Yes, absolutely. But before I kind of answer that question directly, let me clarify a couple of things. So first of all, today, the VMware Cloud AWS service is available only in certain AWS regions. Specifically, we have it in North America on the West Coast and in the Oregon region, as well as in North Virginia on the East Coast. And recently, we opened up the AWS UK London region. The next region that we're going to is in Frankfurt in Germany. And, you know, precisely, we're just talking about the GDPR issue, as you were asking. So it's definitely impacting in terms of, you know, how we thinking about delivering the service and, you know, the things that we build into the service to ensure that we comply with these requirements.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and bring in my co-host, Lou. Let's start with you, because I've seen you bouncing in your seat a little bit. You've got a question about cost analysis.
Yeah, so I think a lot of one of the cloud hosts do today, like for instance, Rackspace, IBM, Microsoft, Google, they all have these like TCO calculators to kind of show you the total cost of ownership. And like, so maybe you can give us a little insights on, like, for instance, VMware on Azure. They showed over a 3-year period, if you have 500 VMs, it could roughly save you almost $4 million depending on how you're hosting it. Is there something like that that's kind of offered for AWS to kind of show that year-by-year savings and how, you know, moving from an on-premise to the kind of the cloud or hosted version of it?
Yeah, so we have a number of tools that are available today, and there is a few more that are going to be coming online very soon here. So if you go to the VMware Cloud AWS website, we have general overview in terms of how the TCO compares against the usual alternative. So, and so essentially what we usually do is look at the alternatives. The alternatives here being traditional on-premises infrastructure, as well as these native cloud instances. So that's typically what we compare TCO on. What you will see on the webpage, the resources that you can find, there's just general description how the TCO works. We also have some white papers in the resources section that compares us against things like Microsoft Azure and Microsoft Azure Stack. We're also going to very soon be releasing tool on the website itself that allows customers to plug in their different configuration for their environment and get a TCO comparison against a traditional on-premises infrastructure.
All right. Chibert, you actually had a question more about the case studies, how this has actually been used.
Yeah, actually, I'm curious. Are there some particularly famous customers that you can mention? Like, for instance, a while back when virtualization was the big deal and EC2 first was available, there was a story about the New York Times that had scanned all their back issues but had not indexed them. And they actually spun up a whole bunch of virtual machines on EC2 and indexed them over a weekend and saved a bunch of money. Do you have some success stories that you might be able to share with our viewers?
So we do have a couple stories. Unfortunately, I'm not allowed to share them publicly. I haven't gotten permission from the customers. The one I will say that's interesting, as you know, VMware runs VMworld every year. And then we migrated the entire VMworld infrastructure, whether it's the website, the app that comes in, into VMware Cloud and AWS and hosting it, for the upcoming VMworld. So if you think about, business critical, mission critical applications with over 20,000 attendees attending VMworld and, being able to, have the capacity and mission critical infrastructure supporting all the users, all the hands-on labs that we run, all the mobile clients that we're supporting. So that is one environment that I can talk about running on a VMware Cloud AWS. We do have some very interesting story. I wish I could I could mention them publicly. We're trying to secure the permission of our customers to talk about it publicly, but I don't have that permission at this point.
I'm glad that you brought up VMworld, because that's actually going to be the last tech conference that I cover before I have to ship out of the United States. But it also brings up the question, what are we going to see there? I mean, obviously, this is probably going to be one of the big announcements at the show. You're going to be really pushing this VMware in AWS. But at that point, will I be able to see more of those customers that you can't talk about right now? I mean, how quickly is this being adopted?
So we're generally, in terms of the adoption of this service, we have a large number of customers on the service. It's exceeding our expectation, exceeding our goals that we set for ourselves. And by the time we go to VMworld, as we actually done in a previous VMworld, we will have number of customers on stage talking about their experience with the service, talking about what they're doing with it. So you will see that. And definitely, if you go to last year's VMworld, there's a number of customers that we had that spoke about their experience with VMware Cloud and AWS, even though it was only 2 weeks after we made the service available to them. As we get into the next VMworld, it'll be a year since we launched it, and there's definitely going to be a lot of good stories as well as interesting ones like the one you mentioned a couple minutes ago.
Indeed. Okay. Is there anything else that you can impart upon our audience? If they are just starting to play with VMware, if they are looking at this as a potential deployment for their enterprise, for their medium to small business, what would you like them to know about using this?
So I think at high level, a couple points. If companies are thinking about moving to public cloud for whatever reason, as I mentioned, a number of different use cases, going to VMware Cloud AWS, if they are already a VMware customer, when they're already using vSphere on premises, is going to be the easiest migration path to public cloud. And once they have their workloads there, it's going to be the simplest and most consistent way of operating them without them having to learn any new skills or build out new processes. It's going to be consistent infrastructure, consistent operation with what they're already familiar with, while getting the benefits of the enterprise-rich features that VMware is known for offering for private cloud.
So one last question for me. I think one question is, does this help with also as you kind of move your and migrate to the AWS cloud? Does it also help to essentially maybe upsell some of their services, like migrating to Redshift and that kind of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. As customers are thinking about moving their on-premises workloads, on-premises applications into VMware Cloud AWS, often these days or traditionally they come in as a multi-tier applications. Some of them involve having data. So as they're migrating the applications, they're also thinking about migrating the data. So having the data sitting in some of the AWS services is one of the common examples that we see with the current customers. Definitely, and also there's a lot of interest in using some of the more innovative AWS services. Lambda is usually kind of on top of that list, where as they're migrating their applications and modernizing them to take advantage of those AWS services, and that's where AWS gets the opportunity to upsell their features and capabilities.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You've used up another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 VMware AWS clusters. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible. Of course, that means our guest. Ivan, thank you so very much for spending your time with us, for letting us know about a very important development in cloud services. If you could please tell our audience where they can find you, where they can find VMware, where they can find out more information about running VMware on AWS.
So if they can go to cloud.vmware.com/bmc-aws, all the resources for VMware Cloud AWS are available on that website, and that's the one you're showing in the windows now.
Fantastic. Ivan, again, thank you for joining us, and we wish you all the best. Thank you for being part of TWiT.
Thank you, and my pleasure.
And of course, we need to thank, my co-hosts. Without them, I wouldn't want to do the show. They make it a lot of fun, and they make it easy because it's just a bunch of geeks talking about what they love. Chibert, let's start with you. What are you doing over the next week? Where can people find you, and where can people find your work?
I am, as always, ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab on Twitter, and I'm also Chibert at twit.tv. Now, I do want to give a teaser to our audience. This was actually the first of our VMware series that's going to be going on. We're actually going to be having other VMware product managers on there, like VMware Workspace. They're going to be focusing on mobile security, VMware Healthcare. We're going to have someone doing a deep dive on the networking, cloud management, and security. And oh, just so that Lou doesn't feel left out, we're also going to have a whole bunch of Microsoft Office partners on talking about plugins for the Office environment. In fact, next week, we're going to have some of these people talking about some brand new collaboration tools. So stay tuned. We've got lots of good quiet goodness coming your way.
And folks, remember, Chibert is actually the producer. He took over the producer role for me about, what, a year and a half, 2 years ago. So he's the one who's been getting all these wonderful guests for Twiat. If you like our guests, if you like the topics that we cover, make sure that you reach out to him. Again, what's your Twitter address, Chibert?
I am ADVNETLAB, Advanced Network Laboratory.
So if you like our guests, reach out to him. If you don't like our guests, scream at him. It's on Twitter. There you go. Also, Lou Maresca, always a pleasure to work with you, my friend. It's kind of amazing that I've actually been working with you since the start of my time at Twit. And again, you were in the single digits episodes of Twit. Then you were my co-host on Coding 101. And, well, it's so nice to work with you. What will you be up to, and where can people find your work?
Well, you can always find me on Twitter at LouMM. And of course, all my work that I do here at Microsoft is at dev.office.com. Check out, click on Excel or Word or whatever, and you can check out the different developments of building add-ins and integrations with Office. And of course, we're getting ready for Build. It's coming up soon.
And I will probably be there. So, yay. I'll be able to join you up in Seattle. This will be fun. Folks, thanks to them, we get to do Twiat, and also thanks to a few other people who make sure that everything is ready to go. That includes my engineers, to Jammer B and Alex, the angry one, and Burke, and also to Lisa and Leo, who have allowed us to continue doing This Week in Enterprise Tech all these years. We owe them so, so much, as do we you. That's right. You stop by every week. You listen to us. You watch us. You download us. Without you, we wouldn't have a show, and we want to make it easier for you to get your enterprise fix. Just go to twit.tv/Twiat. That's T-W-I-E-T, This Week in Enterprise Tech. There you'll find all of our back episodes along with our show notes. If there was a story that we talked about, a blip or a byte or a guest that you want to contact, you're going to find all that information by going to twit.tv/Twiat and then clicking on that episode. Also, as long as you're there, why not subscribe? This is the best way to support the show. You can get an audio version, a video version, or a high-definition video version that will be automatically delivered into your device of choice each week. Again, if you want to see Twiat, that's probably the best way to do it. I also want to direct you over to something that I do at Twitter, twitter.com/PadreSJ. This is the best place to keep up with me. I'm not always in the studio. A lot of times I'm jumping around the world, and I try to keep my Twitter feed updated. If you want to know what I'm doing or where I am or what event I'm currently covering, that's the best way to reach out. Again, twitter.com/PadreSJ. Oh, well, that's David Hewitt in Shape of Water. He was on my plane. Well, in the screen. Yeah, I'm cool like that. Finally, thanks to my TD, Kevin. And Kevin, you know that this is coming. Every episode, we try to ask you something to see if you were actually paying attention to the show that you were switching. Are you ready for a little bit of knowledge drop on you?
A cloud of knowledge dropping on... Yeah, my head.
Okay.
Like rain.
Here's a very simple one. What does MFA stand for?
It's probably inappropriate to say on here.
No, I'm sorry. It's multi-factor authentication. Nice try, Kevin.
Like
but
a Long Island iced tea.
Maybe you'll get it next week. Until then, I'm Father Robert Ballister, the Digital Jesuit. And just remember, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiat. We'll